thank you for downloading or streaming this episode of Band Biographies. You can find more episodes at bandbiographies.com. That's B-A-N-N-E-D biographies.com. If you enjoy it, why not leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whatever service you use to listen to your podcasts? Apparently, it helps get the show up the charts so more people can see it, to download it, and then to leave further 5-star reviews. Another way you can help is by telling as many friends as possible to give it a download. Please do reach out on Twitter at BandBiogs, on Instagram at BandBiographies, search on Facebook for BandBiographies, or by emailing bandbiographies@gmail.com. But most of all, enjoy. Welcome to this special interview episode of the Band Biographies podcast. On this episode, you'll hear a conversation I had a few months back with documentary and filmmaker Aaron Pendergast. Aaron is currently in post-production on a documentary about the Blasting Room, the legendary recording studio started by members of the band's Descendants and All in the mid-90s. If you're a fan of US punk from the 80s through to today, which I am, you'll likely be a fan of at least one, if not many, of the bands who have recorded albums at the Blasting Room. And you'll likely own albums that were recorded, mixed, or mastered there. Essentially, the Blasting Room documentary will be to punk rock what the Sound City documentary was to the Foo Fighters. Aaron was great to talk to and imparted some brilliant advice for anyone looking to make independent films and documentaries, as well as being very generous with his time and a great raconteur. Unfortunately, there was a technical issue with distortion on Aaron's end of the Zoom call that I just couldn't edit around. We noticed it early on in the call, and Aaron sent me files that he recorded on his end as well, but the issue was still there in his files. I've done what I can to lessen the effect and edit out as much of it as possible, but it's obviously still there. I hope you're able to listen around it. Now, I hope to have Aaron on again in the future to talk about the reception of the film when it's released towards the end of the year in September or October. You can find out more about the film at blastingroomfilm.com or on Instagram at blastingroomfilm. Technical issues aside, I really hope you enjoy the conversation, and I'm sure you'll get something out of it, especially if you're into US punk rock bands or independent filmmaking. An additional shout out goes to my friend Zach Eastman for setting this up. He was working on the Blasting Room film with Aaron, and he also has film-based podcasts called Real Nerds, The Yesteryear Ballyhoo Review, and Surrounded by A-Holes, which I heartily recommend that you go and listen to if you're into film. But without further ado, I give you my interview with Aaron Pendergast. So Aaron Pendergast, director of the Blasting Room documentary, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Exciting to be here.
Whereabouts in the world do we find you today?
I am in the Denver area in Colorado.
And just on the cusp of a move as well, I understand.
That is correct. Yeah, we actually close on selling our condo tomorrow. And then we rent it back for 2 months while our new house is being completed. So,
in which case, I really value and appreciate your time today. So before we get into the documentary itself, I'm just going to ask a couple of kind of quick fire-ish getting to know you type questions so that I and the listeners can get to know you at the same time.
Great.
So first off, this is not your first rodeo in documentary and short filmmaking before. I think I've seen you've got a couple of other credits on IMDb, if I'm looking at the right Aaron Pendergast, of course. Is it Floating Horses and The Buffalo King?
Yes, those are the other two feature films that I've worked on.
And talk us through some of the projects that you've done.
I've done pretty much exclusively documentary work in the field. And I mean, did some, you know, reality television and like narrative stuff when I was in school and that. But in film school was when I got into the documentary thing, and I just kind of stuck with it. Made a short doc. People really liked it. So I thought I was doing something right. But I've also tried to diversify the work that I've done. So my first short film was about a wounded veteran. And then, of course, after I made that, a bunch of other, you know, veterans organizations and former soldiers and stuff were coming up to me and saying, oh, I know this guy, it's a great story, this would be a great story. And I didn't want to be like the military doc guy, because again, like, I'm making a punk rock documentary, I'm not exactly pro-industrial military complex, but you know, this is a good friend of mine, so that's why I wanted to tell the story. Yeah. So I was like, I need to not do that at all. So I feel like every project has like a similarity to the previous one, but it's like a little bit different narrative, right? So like right after that one about my friend, I did, he had two prosthetic legs after his injury. And then we did a short documentary about a dog with prosthetics. And then right. We did a short documentary about a wolf sanctuary. So it was like the canine connection, but like a new, you know, so everyone's just kind of like built off of an aspect of the previous one, but try to be a little different. The two feature films I did, Buffalo King, Floating Horses, were both like historical biographies on figures in South Dakota. Mm. And that's because I was partnering with a guy named Justin Kaler, who's from South Dakota. So he was kind of the director, producer, head of those projects. And I just kind of came on to help produce, edit, be part of the crew, you know, just again, it's in, with, especially with independent documentaries, you kind of do everything in a small crew and everybody does a little bit of all of it. So it's, you know, it's nice because you learn a lot of things, but it's also like you're not, you get in that film school mentality of having like a whole crew because everybody needs credit for class, right? But then you get out of it and it's like you can barely scrape together four people to make a movie after that. So, but it's fun. I like doing it. So that's, this one was kind of, I'd worked with Justin on a few. He's gotten less available, just like he has a family and they just had their second kid. It might have been 2 years ago. COVID makes everything weird. I don't know what how much time has passed.
Certainly does.
Yeah. But he's just too, you know, with family obligations and work, and just doesn't have the time that he had when we were doing those features before. Mm. So he started up a short film, but it was just kind of a, you know, I think he's still working on it. He probably started it before we started blasting it, and he's still working on it just because time is so hard to come by anymore.
This is one of those things, especially in the independent kind of arena as well. It's all about budget, isn't it? And availability of people and how everyone can fit into the schedule.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, I mean, especially, yeah, being a parent with two kids, like not as much disposable income as he had before to put movies together. and then funding them is so hard. I mean, just getting, you need to do something where you actually need money. And it's a slog. And that's one thing I'll give Justin. He had a knack for finding money and making these things happen. I don't know how he did it. I wish I could do that. But.
Well, this is it. I mean, one of the questions that I wanted to ask a little bit later, but as we're on that kind of area now, what is it that a producer actually does, for those who don't know? I mean, I think people have got a relatively clear idea of what a director does, a cameraman, a lighting guy. But what's the producer's role?
That's a really good question. And it's funny because there's a lot, right? You have like your producers and your executive producers and your line producers, associate producers, right? So there's a lot of different names for it. I think in like the Hollywood space, a producer is kind of the person who helps get the money to make the movie and then kind of determines how it gets spent. Mm-hmm. At least that's kind of my like pedestrian understanding of it, because I've never actually worked in the industry in that capacity. But for me as a producer, what I do in this indie film space is that I'm finding the money, I'm scheduling, planning everything, the execution, just like defining like this is when we need to kind of halt production and start post-production. And this is how much we have budget-wise allocated to spend on production-related expenses, and here's how much is post. And so when that money's gone, it's gone. So even if we don't have everything we wanted to shoot, we're just going to have to live without it because we need the funds for licensing or whatever else. So. And then that's the other thing I do is outside of scheduling is like contacting record labels to get rights for music, or, you know, coordinating crew and travel schedules. And those are some things where probably like, you know, on a bigger production, like a line producer might be the one dealing with the budget and things. But for, you know, again, in the indie space, it's just kind of like producer is the umbrella for it. I will say executive producer is a vanity credit and you buy that credit. So that one is the one I know for sure.
So when you see Hollywood star name exec producer, they really haven't done very much at all.
Exactly. Yeah. They basically put up the money to get the movie made.
Sure. But like you say, on independent films and documentaries and stuff, you're kind of doing a bit of everything. It's all hands to the deck, isn't it? At all times, I guess.
Pretty much. Yeah. You really have to just, I mean, we like Floating Horses. If you watch that movie, and I'm not saying this to brag at all, it's to me, it's insane to think that if you watch that movie, that crew was two people for that entire production, at least the production side. Post, we had an audio engineer do the final mix and a composer with the music, but I mean, that was it, right? So thinking that that's all we had to put that together, when I look at it, I'm like, man, I don't know how we did it, but here we are. And thankfully with Blasting Room, we've had a few more people to help. So typically we have at least three crew members instead of two. Sometimes it's two. I was actually shooting something 2 days ago and it was, well, no, actually we had two. I went there solo, but I had a friend in town who does production that she helped me out.
Okay. A mutual friend of ours, Zach Eastman, has helped you out on a couple of bits on the Blasting Room doc as well.
He has, yeah. He's been on set a few times and he's doing some producing work like for us. Like he's helping me get all the releases we forgot to get signed by all the bands and things that were in the movie. We try to have him on hand, but sometimes it's like my co-producer, Kevin, he had printed out some for some interviews he was doing while I was out of town and like printed them out, had them ready to go and then forgot to bring. So, you know.
Again, it's all kind of time management and there isn't a lot of spare time to manage all these different jobs, isn't there?
Yeah.
So you kind of alluded a little bit earlier that you were kind of coming, especially in this documentary, but I suppose from you personally, you were saying kind of coming from a kind of punk rock background. I mean, is that the kind of music that you're into?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I mean, that's what was so exciting about this movie for me is like so many of these bands that are recorded at the Blast Room. I'd like to say it's every single one, but it's definitely not. But a large percentage of bands that are recorded at the Blasting Room, I love and have been listening to for years. So getting to do a movie where I get to like talk to all of these musicians is pretty mind-blowing. Like teenager me would not believe that I was actually doing this because I was just obsessed with like, the Ataris and Apple and Trio and like, Hot Water Music and all these bands. And then actually getting to sit down and interview them and having to not be a fanboy. Getting to work with these bands. And, you know, I try to be professional when I interview. Like, I think it's important, right? They deal with fans all the time and you're here to work to make this movie. So I try not to like fanboy out when I meet these guys and just stick to script, be professional. Get what we need done, get out of the way. Like, they get enough of that throughout the day and they're doing us a favor already. So
it's, yeah. It's something that I've had on here. I've had one or two people from bands that I've really loved from my teenage years right up to now. And always very conscious of taking up their time and not wasting it as well, you know, trying to kind of get an interesting conversation out of it. Maybe not one that they've talked about to death in the past as well. Trying to find things that are interesting to them too. But did you ever play in bands when you were younger? Were you a musician or a singer or anything like that?
I in like middle school, high school, I played in the like, you know, concert band or whatever. I played saxophone. I wanted to sing in a band, but I didn't have the like balls to do it. You know, like I was like too much of an introvert to like actually get up and do it. So I never did, but I was willing to. So this is kind of like, I get to live vicariously through the bands I love now.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And it's one of those things. I think singers, I've done lead vocals, but I prefer playing an instrument as well as singing. I just feel like there's something about having a physical object to hide behind.
Right. Yeah. That, like it's a barrier kind of, right? Yeah,
absolutely. Do you remember a time when you either heard a song or you watched a film and you thought, that's what I'd like to have a career in? I'd like to do that as a job.
Yeah, honestly, what I want to say it was, and it's like, it's sad that this was it, but for whatever reason, it stuck with me. I remember sitting in like, my geography class in middle school, like just thinking about the moment, the one with Brendan Fraser that came out in the 90s. I went and saw that, and it was just such a like over the top, fun, ridiculous thing that I was like, man, I want to do that. Like, I want to make those kind of things, like those kind of stories. Yeah. And I never really like thought about it before that of, you know, what did I want to do when I got older, but that really clicked. But at that age too, I didn't know like what was involved in making a movie, right? When you're like 12, like all you can think about is, you know, there's like actors and directors and that's it, right?
Yeah.
And I don't remember exactly what it was. But yeah, it's, you know, then as you get older, you realize the different roles and things. So that was kind of, I think, where it first hit, but I never took it seriously until high school. And my buddy Chris he worked for like the TV station at the high school, and he was editing music video for this AMV competition we had, which is like an animated music video thing for this anime convention. He wanted to see that. And I was watching him edit and like just the timing he was doing with the music to the shots and everything. It's like, this is fucking cool. I want to do that. So that's what got me into editing and realizing more, you know, roles in movies other than directors and actors. And so that, then I was like, hey, can you teach me how to do this? So then he was kind of showing me how to edit. And after that, I was like, well, this, I'm going to be an editor now. I wanted to edit action movies, going back to the Mummy thing, but it just kind of, you know, fell into like the opposite, into documentary, right?
And what is it about documentary that attracts you more to that style than feature films, for example?
It really is just kind of a, that's how things happen. So I, when I went to school, initially, because Colorado, like at the time, I didn't think had any film schools. We sort of did, but I ended up at a community college in Greeley, which is northern Colorado, kind of near the city, the Blaster region. And they had a television production program. So part of that was they were pretty much priming you to intern at and work for the news stations in Colorado. So I learned a lot about lighting, interviewing, framing for putting someone on camera for an interview. So then when I got to film school many years later, and my buddy Jesse got hurt, and I was telling everyone there his story, and he was a very inspiring individual. You should do a movie about this. This is great. I was trying to figure out like a narrative approach to like fictionalize his experience in a way. And then I was like, this is dumb. You know how to do interviews, like just do a documentary. So we did a doc about him because again, I had that TV background and that interview background. So it's like, okay, this kind of, I can do this and probably do a better job than if I try to do a narrative line. It's still pretty green, you know? And it was received so well that it kind of just became the thing that it was like, well, I guess I'm the documentary guy now. So I started kind of planning the next one. And then I met Justin in reality television. He was getting this Buffalo King thing going. I wanted somebody who'd done a documentary before to help him out because he'd never done one, at least to completion. He'd shot something, but it never went anywhere. So it just, yeah, and I just kind of kept doing it. And because they kept being well received, I was, I guess I'm good at it. I might as well stick to it. You know? I won't say that I'm good at it, but they seem to be doing okay.
They get recognition. That's what matters. It's yeah, absolutely. And just before we get onto the kind of main thing of meeting various bands and being fans of various bands, I always like to try and skewer anyone's punk rock credibility or indie credibility by asking what their first single or album was that you bought with your own money.
So I was thinking about this because it's so hard to remember. And again, going back to the moving thing, all of my CDs are boxed up. So I'm like, I can't even like look at my collection and be like, which one of those did I get first? But I want to say, and I'm not saying this to be cool, I'm saying this because I genuinely think it was. I think it was Dookie by Green Day.
Well, yeah, okay, fine.
And the only reason I think that was, I remember when it came out in 94, so I was either in the tail end of third grade or beginning of fourth grade. And I remember going to my friend Tim Tormey's house, and he had the CD, and we were listening to it. And I specifically remember the song Pulling Teeth. And I was like, I really like this. This is really cool. But I was still in like, you know, grade school, so I didn't have any money of my own at that point. But I feel like once I had like an allowance and I was allowed to like walk to the mall without my parents, I went to the record store there and bought it so I could hear that song.
And growing up, were kind of record stores, were they important to you as a young kid kind of finding his way? Or did you have older siblings or anything like that who had kind of where you could they filter down their music taste sometimes, you know?
I think it was a combination of like, so my dad was a musician who played drums in bands when he was younger. And so he had a big music collection where I listened to a lot of his. So like, to be fair, like the stuff I was into, I was into a lot of other things before I heard that Green Day record just because what I had access to, you know, so it was like the Beatles and Steely Dan, Dire Straits, Led Zeppelin, like whatever my dad had playing around, basically, right. I would listen to. And then, yeah, we had the like mall in town was maybe like 10-minute walk from my house. So we would like a lot of times friends would come over and we just walk to the mall and go hang out in the record store or, you know, go hang out at the video game store, or whatever, you know, like the like two or three places we go in the mall were, right?
Yeah.
And we had a big record store. It was like, I think it was like should have been two different stores that were like combined into one because there were like stairs to get between the two parts of it.
Right.
So I mean it was like it was a big place, and then they had those like kiosks set up where you put on the headphones and you could button to like listen to the different albums. So we spent so much time in there just like listening to stuff and browsing, you know, stuff we couldn't buy, but just for something to do. So yeah, I think it was kind of like that. And then also just my dad being a musician and being passionate about music kind of fostered that.
Yeah, it seems like you've got a good base there with your father's music collection. I mean, that's a pretty good level to start on, is kind of Led Zeppelin, Steely Dan, the Beatles. You can't go too far wrong when that's your base. Did you kind of rebel against that? I think lots of people go through a rebellious phase, but did you?
I don't think so. I liked a lot of that stuff, and I continued to listen to it even though I was getting into the punk rock thing. I know my dad didn't like the punk rock thing, so that's part of why I was like almost like more leaning into it, because it was that rebellious, like, well, I do like your stuff, but there's this other cool stuff too.
This is mine.
Yeah.
And when you're getting a little bit older in high school and what have you, when did you start going to gigs?
My first show, sadly, I shouldn't say sadly, it took a while for me to start learning live music. That's why it's sad, because it's like, I wish I would have gotten stuff sooner. But my very first concert was 2002, the Pop Disaster Tour with Jimmy Eat World, Green Day, and Blink 182.
That's a show.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. But yeah, it was like at that point, I mean, I love that was my first concert, but man, I've been missing out for so many years. I should have been doing this sooner.
So you weren't doing kind of basement shows or anything like that. Was that happening in Denver at that point?
I think so. I grew up in Fort Collins, so it's about an hour north of Denver. And we had a little venue called the Aggie that used to be a movie theater that they turned into a venue. So I think they were happening, but I just wasn't tapped into that scene, right? Mm-hmm. Like, for, you know, it was just for whatever reason, we were kind of very much on the, like, you know, mainstream bandwidth, going to kind of like the like known venues. And this is pre-internet too, right? So it's kind of hard to find out when shows were happening, where they were, if you didn't like know somebody who knew the venue or the event that was going on. So
yeah.
As I've gotten older, I've found I hate going to big stadium shows, and like like, I need smaller venues.
Yeah.
You know, we've got, I don't even know the head counts, but for me, if it's like bigger than like the Ogden or the Gothic here in Colorado, like, I don't want to go. Those are like the biggest places I'll go. Yeah. And they probably hold 100 people or something. And even that's like, I would prefer something smaller.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'm similar. Like, most of the bands that I want to go and see, I'm lucky that they go and play the Brixton Academy up in London. And that's about as big as I really like as well. And that's probably a couple of thousand, but, yeah, any bigger than that. And I just think there's no connection. And especially these days with the crash barriers being so far away from the stage, you just can't get close.
Well, I feel like you have a higher concentration in those smaller venues of people who really want to be there, and you can like feed off that energy. When you're in those big stadiums, it's like, once you get back a certain amount, like, nobody's singing, nobody's like, they're all just, they're kind of there because like, oh yeah, I know that one song.
Right. Yeah.
But in those smaller venues, it feels like almost everyone is singing along to every word. Like, you're there because you love that band. You know? So it's just, I don't know, it's a more communal, like you said, like, the energy is just better. Feel like you're part of something.
And what was the last gig you went to see?
Oh gosh, that's a tricky one. So the last proper live show I went to was the Blaster Room 25th anniversary.
Right.
I've technically seen two other bands live since then. But it was, we did a live stream for Teenage Bottle Rocket and a live stream for Red City Radio. So it was like the crew and like a couple, like the staff at the venue and like a few friends. And that was it. So, I mean, it was like, it was a live show, but not really a live show. And I was also working, so I couldn't really enjoy it.
Yeah.
But yeah, those were the last ones that I've been to. I am going to, Jawbreaker, The Descendants, and Face to Face on April 7th. So that'll be my first proper live show in 2 years.
Excellent. I was supposed to have been going to see the Dropkick Murphys and the Interrupters last month, but they cancelled.
Oh no.
And they haven't rescheduled yet, which is annoying, except that they're both playing Slam Dunk Festival over here in the summer. And you're like, oh. Annoying.
Hopefully they'll add a date to make up for that.
Fingers crossed, although they're saying that the Interrupters aren't going to be the support act next time round, which is a bummer.
Yeah, that's too bad.
I love that band.
Yeah, they're a great band.
So which is your biggest love? Is it film or music? What would you say?
It's honestly probably music, because that's really, like, for me, that's where everything starts, right? Like, it's always something like even with the blasting room, obviously it's, you know, it's about the music, but I'll like hear a song and go, oh shit, this is going to be this part of the movie. Like just because of the song has inspired that idea, you know? And that's for me. I mean, even like growing up, I was big into video games too, but I would never listen to the video game audio. I would always have my own music playing and just playing the game. So then it was like years later, people talk about video game soundtracks. And oh, I guess they do have music. I just never listen to it. So I kind of always go back to that of like, music is such a big part of my life that really a lot of my movie ideas are inspired by just hearing a song and hearing, like that makes me visualize something I could do in a movie and I'm like, okay, now how do I apply this to an idea I have for a movie? Right. So I do think it's like probably my biggest source of joy and inspiration as far as like the content that I consume.
And have you ever thought then about going into music video production perhaps?
So that was initially kind of when I was doing those music videos with my friend that got me into editing. I had thought about doing the music video thing. I just don't really know how you get into that from like, you know, at least in a sustainable, like I can do this as a career as opposed to just helping out like a local band and doing it for
sure,
you know, a little bit of money or for free maybe. I will say I did love putting together that Red City Radio Live thing. It was a really, really fun time. So that's something. And that was kind of like a music video type setting. So. I think I could do it if it, you know, became something that was more manageable. But I know, like, growing up, I was always kind of critical of these videos because I was like, this doesn't make any sense for what this song is. Like, a lot of the times, you're just like, what does it seem supposed to be? But as I've gotten older, I realize they're trying to, you know, be like artistic or something.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. There's sometimes you watch a video and you think this has got nothing to do with what I feel. I think that's the thing with music, isn't it? It's so much more subjective than any other art form. And when someone puts images to it, you're like, well, that doesn't vibe with how I feel about this song. Like, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's it, right? It's like my interpretation of it is just off enough that I don't understand what they're trying to do. But...
And I suppose as well, perhaps the music video isn't such a major part of a band's marketing campaign anymore because... Are people watching videos now in the age of streaming? I don't know.
That's hard to say. I mean, you see a lot of like lyric videos for songs because they're easy to make. But I mean, is anybody doing that? Or are they just on Spotify getting suggestions or just listening to stations on there calling it good? You know, I don't like, I'm like the weird one out that all of my friends send me Spotify links. So check out this. And I'm like, I don't have Spotify. I can't check that out.
Yeah. I don't do Spotify either. If I'm honest with you, I just, I don't know. I've got an old school kind of, I want the album. Like I want to listen to the whole thing from start to back. Cause
exactly. Yeah.
Having been in bands as well, I know the thought process that goes into creating them. And it's like, it should be a journey. In a way, or you should be, you know, it's curated. So why not listen to it that way, I guess, but.
Exactly. Well, it's like,
to sound too old.
But I know exactly what you mean because it to me, yeah, it's like, there's something about, you know, they wrote that as a cohesive thing, right? It's not meant to be taken in pieces. So it's like, you want to experience that. Now, once I've like listened to something enough and I'm familiar with it, then I'll go ahead and throw it into the shuffle playlist and let things pop up as they come. But yeah, that initially, like when I get a new record, it's like, I want to just listen to it all the way through many, many times before I, you know, happy that I'm like, okay, I get it. I can move on or, you know, go back to just mixing things up. But
yeah.
But yeah, I can't, the Spotify thing, I feel like I'm just throwing money away because I don't buy enough new music in a year to make it, you know, worth. Like I'd spend more on Spotify than I do buying new music. So it's like, I'll just keep buying new music.
Yeah, I'm with you there. So what was it that made you want to make a documentary about the blasting room? Was it your idea in the first place? Was it pitched to you by someone else?
It was my idea and kind of, I was trying to, like we were talking about earlier with budget, right? It's always tricky getting the funds to do things. And so I was trying to come up with something that was local, like, in Colorado, a scene that I was a part of. So I had some knowledge and some basis to come from to not be like an outsider coming in. And then also, again, just from a cost standpoint, if it was local, it'd be a lot easier to shoot, right? I wouldn't have to fly crew places. We could go like day trips, get stuff shot. And for whatever reason, like I've been aware of the Blast Room since like 2000 or 2001 or something as a place that existed, but it never clicked as a potential subject for a film until one night my wife was traveling for work. So I was like home alone, drinking beer, watching Sound City. And, you know, it like ended. And I was like, I didn't like the end of that movie just because he just like brings a bunch of famous people over to make a record. And I was like, well, like you lost me. Like it was my level until here. And now this isn't just kind of showing off, I feel like, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So I was like, I love this, but I want something a little more down to earth. And the Blast Room kind of clicked into my brain. That's the idea. That's what we got to do. So yeah, that's kind of where it came from. It's just this like need to make my own feature film, but do something that, like, even if money were an obstacle, we could realistically move it forward. And I figured with the studio, it's like, well, the band comes to town to make a record. You catch them when they're in town making a record. The staff's up there, so we talk to them whenever. It's kind of, you know, if we got to travel a little bit, we can. But just, yeah, something that was more financially realistic to try to tackle.
Yeah, because I think one of the touchstones for me, I was like, well, this is the Sound City of the punk rock world, isn't it?
Right.
Can you explain a little bit about why the Blasting Room is such an important recording studio? Like, what makes it interesting enough to have a documentary made about it?
I think it's really it's like the DIY nature of how it started and how it kind of continues to run. And that it was really like, you know, basically three punk kids with no money, like were able to create what's ultimately kind of a state-of-the-art recording studio in a small town in Colorado. And like every punk band that started in the 90s or early 2000s has had something touched by the Blast Room, right? Like if they haven't recorded there, the mastering was done or something, right? But everybody's had something touched by the Blasting Room if they've been in a band in the punk scene. Part of the draw was that it was the guys from the Descendants and All that started the studio, I think. But just, I mean, looking at how they started it, it's like, it's such a, you know, they made something out of nothing and they saw this potential and they, like, you know, you don't think of punks as being business savvy, but they were like, hey, instead of like throwing away this record, this advance from the label, let's build something permanent out of it. And it, yeah, I mean, to me, it's like, it's inspiring. And it's also, you know, coming from a place of where I think a lot of punk rockers come from, like not having a lot of resources, not having a lot of money at their disposal or whatever it is, and creating something really special with what little they had. It's just a really inspiring place. And then it's also kind of a parallel for us making this movie, is we're also independents and don't have any backing or real money, and it's a very DIY film as well, so that kind of lessons in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. Was it Bill Stevenson that set it up? He was one of the original guys.
Yes, Bill, Carl, and Stefan from the Descendants and All. And then Jason Livermore came in pretty early and just kind of slept on the couch and learned from those guys how to do engineering and stuff.
And it was set up on the back of a record company advance, was it? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so when after the Descendants kind of split and All became a thing, they had a record deal with Interscope. So the advance they got from that deal, they said, hey, let's get this space and buy a console and make our own studio. Because normally they would use that for recording time, but they figured if we make our own space, then we can just make our own records. Stefan and Bill had been kind of like picking things up and working with the engineers and learning how to make records when they had done other records. So they kind of knew what they were doing. So they were like, well, if we have the gear, we can record ourselves, you know, mix and master ourselves. And then we don't have to worry about not having money to do that anymore. But there was enough of like a following and an ethos behind the Descendants and All that all these other bands immediately started calling them up. Hey, will you record us? Can we come to your studio and get recorded? So it just kind of turned into, like, they didn't set out to do it, but that's what it ended up becoming.
I mean, just mentioning a couple of those bands, I mean, just a brief list, you look at them and it's, yeah, obviously All and the Descendants, but you've also got the Ataris, Lagwagon, MXPX, Less Than Jake, Rise Against, Anti-Flag, The Casualties, Propagandhi, No Effects, The Lemonheads, Me First and the Gimme Gimmes, Puddle of Mud, No News to a Name, Gaslight Anthem, Nerf Herder, Teenage Bottle Rocket, Street Dogs, Joey Cape, The Bouncing Souls, Alkaline Trio, Big D and The Kids Table. I mean, they're just a few, and they are, a lot of those are massive names in certainly in my record collection. And it's, you know, like you say, almost every band in that particular scene has gone through there. Who, out of all of those bands, how many kind of subjects in the documentary have you managed to track down? You were saying that you were recording there and whoever was in, you would try and get on camera, but did you have big names that you wanted and did you get them?
We did. We kind of went in with a list of like, we wanted to balance it, right? We wanted to get some of the like name recognition, the Rise Against, the Ataris, those kind of bands that people even outside of punk rock would be familiar with, right? Because if you're making a movie, you want people to watch it, right? So we wanted to expand beyond just the punk community. But then we also wanted to grab some of the like, smaller names and other people who are connected to the studio, but maybe aren't in a band, but were there in the early days or helped lay the groundwork, have helped build the place up. So it was trying to kind of balance those things out. And then we had that list of we'd like to get these people. And then, you know, COVID happened and then just kept happening. And so a lot of those, like Propagandhi was one. We were going to talk to Chris Hanna, but like with the US to Canada travel's been so weird, we just haven't been able to coordinate it. And now it's like we don't really have a budget to. It's just hard. So not to say we won't get them, but it's, you know, a lot of the people we were hoping to get, we couldn't get. But we've done over 40 interviews for the film.
Wow.
We're basically, I want to say we're done, but not quite. We have that Jawbreaker show that I mentioned. That weekend, we're going to be knocking out the last of the interviews we have. So there's a few people in town that we need to get for that show that we're just going to sit down with then. And then a couple people locally, we just haven't been able to coordinate that we're just that we're going to do like 2-3 days and just do interviews all day and get everybody else knocked out. I don't like that we're still shooting interviews just because I really want to just be post all the time. I've been doing post-production, but like just focusing on the edit, not worrying about additional content. But these are kind of essential people, so we've got to just deal with it. So we'll probably have close to 50 interviews by the time we're done.
Oh, wow. Okay. This is the thing with COVID, isn't it? It's kind of thrown everything out. When did you start filming?
We started in October of 2019. We did the brewing for the 25th anniversary beer at Odell Brewing in Fort Collins.
Okay.
And so we did some B-roll because the studio staff were there to like test the, or they weren't testing the beer yet. They were like pouring in the hops or they were doing some part of the brewing process with the brewer. So we did some B-roll of that and then shot the 25th anniversary show. And then so that was, you know, October, November 2019. And then we all know what happened March 2020. So
yeah,
everything just kind of stopped. The good news before everything stopped, at least, was with the show, we were able to like interview Milo and some studio staff. We got Rise Against was in the studio that December and January, February to work on Nowhere Generation. So we were able to interview the guys from Rise Against and so we were able to pick up a few things before things shut down. But I was actually just yesterday looking at our production schedule and like all the shoot dates we had. And there's like an 8-month pause where we just like we shot something and then we didn't shoot anything for almost 8 months.
That's mad. Were there any who declined to be interviewed? Because I know that some punk rockers can be a bit prickly and some like a little bit of elusiveness still.
Not outright. We've had a few people who've been like difficult to schedule or have kind of just like said like, yeah, sure, we'll do it. And then like, don't respond after that to anything. So you're like,
right. Yeah. Yeah.
And you, I don't know, right. Is it a, they just don't want to be on camera, which I totally understand. And if they don't have to, that's cool. Is it like a COVID thing they're worried about? They don't want to say it, but they're like, really still not comfortable being in the room with people. I mean, that was like Chris Rowe and the Ataris. He's had COVID a couple of times, he thinks. And so he was like, I don't want to get it again. So I don't want to be in a space with people not wearing a mask, but I know for an interview, I'm going to have to not wear a mask. We did actually get him finally 2 days ago. I was in Arizona with Chris Rowe and Bob Hope at Blind Blanket in Mesa and got both of those guys. We interviewed Chris outside so he could not wear a mask, but we kept ours on outside just so that he was, you know, as comfortable as he could be in the situation. Bob even was a little more, less COVID weary than Chris. We were able to do his interview inside in his studio. And we just stayed masked. We lost the mask, but
yeah.
But no, I mean, I've kind of gone on a tangent here, but to answer your question, not really. Most people have been cool about it. It's just been like either a scheduling thing gorgeous day. Like, email's not the best way to get in touch, so like we text them or we message them on Instagram, and then it's like right away response, right? But it's like if you email, like nothing. I think it's also just like communication channels, what works for people. I know for me, like if you message me on Instagram, I'm gonna forget it. Like, I don't mean to, but it just always happens. If I have an email, I'm better with emails. So.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. Some people have, I mean, even in life, some people reply quicker to a WhatsApp than they do a text. And I'm like, what? It's the same thing.
Right.
People just have their preferred methods. But what you bring up about the masks and everything, I mean, it's an interesting point. People have got their own ways of dealing with various COVID anxieties and what have you. And it's interesting because I think there's a lot of people who wanted to get back to shows, for example, but there's still a lot of anxiety in the air about it. So, you know, no, I think those kind of anxieties are completely justified. But yeah, it must. Obviously COVID as a whole has been one of the biggest challenges, but I suppose the scheduling, is that the biggest challenge of making a documentary like this, or are there other more technical challenges or behind the scenes challenges?
It's one of the biggest ones. I think for this specifically, a music documentary, the two biggest challenges with schedules, like getting people right. Because like COVID was kind of nice because nobody was touring, so people were staying put, but it was also hard because, you know, if you couldn't travel or people were like, well, I would be okay if you weren't getting on a plane to get here in the first place, then I would be okay to sit down with. So the scheduling, even with COVID being a thing and people not touring, scheduling was tricky. And then the other part is licensing music for a music doc. Mm. It's very complicated, very difficult. Labels do not advertise licensing costs for music. You kind of have to fill out a form, send it in, and then see what happens. My optimistic, foolish hope is that they look at your budget. The reason they don't advertise is they try to help you out with whatever your budget is for the music of the movie and work with you on a price, as opposed to just having a list price and turning people away right away. Because ultimately what's going to happen is if we can't afford it, we just won't include it. And then they don't make it. Mm. And it's like, well, so you guys can make some money or no money. It's up to you. You know, so hopefully people will be a little more flexible. The good news with this is we have a lot of artists on smaller labels or artists who own their music now. So we don't have to go through the label thing and we can work out. Like, the deal I try to work out initially is if we can get festival distribution rights, because we don't make any money off of festivals.
Right.
If we can get that cleared for little to no cost, then if we get the distribution deal, we'll renegotiate terms for licensing the music with distribution.
Okay.
That way we can put it out in the world as we intended it, but then we're not spending a ton of money up front and then we never get distribution. And then it's like, well, we spent, you know, $8,000 licensing music and it doesn't mean anything. We can't even, you know, realistically sell it to anybody. So,
yeah, because I suppose with bands like NOFX, for example, they're on their own record label. So it would be easier, I suppose, to deal with them if you wanted to get like a NOFX song on there or one of their other label mates than it would be a Sony or an Interscope or someone like that.
Exactly. Yeah. That's where the cost comes in. And again, we've licensed video, like television appearances and things and other movies that we've done. And those, you know, so you're also dealing with like some of the bigger labels that are owned by some of the TV studios. And they will usually have like a festival only deal, again, because you're not monetizing, right? Festivals, you pay to be in the festival and then you don't get any money from the festival. So it's not like we're making money off of their content, but we want to make sure we're okay to stream. So they've been cool with it. So I'm kind of hoping with the music licensing, I've never really dealt with music licensing like this for a movie. So I'm hoping it's kind of the same to it. Where they'll be like, yeah, we'll license it to you like a third of what we normally would, just for that limited distribution option to negotiate.
Okay. And so how close are you to end of production and then eventually the release and going on to the festival circuit?
So in my mind, we are, I think, almost exactly 2 weeks from completion of production and moving strictly into post-production. And then my goal is to have a completed edit by September or October at the latest to make the South by Southwest deadline.
Right.
Because that's kind of the big one we're shooting for. Anytime you make a movie, this is for any of the indie filmmakers out there, shoot for a big festival, right? Like, let somebody tell you no before you give up on big festivals. I don't think you should do all of them, right? But like, pick the one you think is gonna. For us, it's like South by Southwest feels like the right place for this to premiere.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it's like, I'm not gonna do Sundance. That's a lost cause. But South by feels like the right one. If we can't get into that, then we'll bring it down.
Mm.
The other reason too for those is like festivals are weird with rules. Like South by, for example, if you're a feature film, you have to be a North American theater, okay, or they won't show it. So if it's screened or shown anywhere before that, they don't take it. And even if you get into another festival that happened before South by and they've accepted you and you screen it at that festival, they'll pull yours and put something else in. So like it's a very serious thing to not mess with that. So that's the other reason we're like, we'll try that, get the no, and then we'll work on some other places. So we don't.
Fair enough. Wow, I didn't realize it was so cutthroat. But I suppose, you know, they've got to, if they want the exclusive or they want to say that they're the place where this was screened first, then
exactly,
they're going to want to know that.
Right. Well, it helps bring in an audience, right? Bring in more people if it's like the premiere of that movie.
Mm.
We've had a buddy of mine who was in a movie that was premiered at South by Southwest, and before the festival was over, Netflix had purchased exclusive rights to the film. So that's like for a filmmaker, like if you get into it, there's a very good chance you'll get picked up by a buyer at the festival because they go to those big ones, right? Some of the smaller ones, like not to speak ill of it, because I love the South Dakota Film Festival and we've screened both of our movies there. They're great people and they put on a great event, but there are no buyers at South Dakota Film Festival for content. So you're not, you know, you can screen there and it's fun and all that, but you're not going to get a distribution go there. So it's like, the laurels are nice. It helps legitimize your production, but that's not what you want to shoot for as you're kind of like starting.
Yeah. Yeah. If you want to get it picked up. So if someone were to see it at South by Southwest, then is that the way that you're kind of looking to get a further distribution deal through that? Or have you got other avenues in place to go down that route independently later on?
We've got some other options. I like the festival one just because usually if a buyer comes to you and wants the content, that's your best deal, right? That's when you're going to make the most money on your movie. If you approach a distributor, like, well, now anymore, Netflix has gotten big enough and Amazon and all those places. I can't go to them and say, hey, I have a movie they want to look at. I have to go through a third party, like known content, basically a middleman.
Right.
To that, then they will vet it and then send it to Netflix or Amazon, whoever, to for further vetting for them to say, yeah, we'll take this one, right? So then you have to pay that middleman also to handle things. The upside is they have like the lawyers and they know the contracts and they can review everything and make sure you're not screwed. Whereas I would need to hire somebody to do that if we got a deal through one of the festival avenues. But I do have, thankfully, been in contact with other people who've done music docs and punk rock docs and that sort of thing that have connections with some of those, you know, third party places. And a lot of those are actually better because they'll get you placements in multiple avenues. So you'll go through them and they'll get you on Netflix and on Amazon and on some obscure streaming service in Germany or something. Like, you know, they'll kind of get you and like diversify you everywhere where you may have a market to maximize the revenue from it. So we do have some other options, but it's kind of one of those, like, it'd be kind of cool to premiere it at South by and get a deal there.
Yeah, definitely. And going back to the documentary itself, what's been your personal highlight from it so far? What's the major success that you've got from it so far?
Question. I will say, just from like a technical standpoint, it's better than anything I've shot up until now, which is cool. Like, it's always nice to see that gradual improvement in the quality of your work.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I think for me, the biggest highlight is feeling like I'm kind of like, in a way, part of the Blasting Room's extended family now, like just being able to kind of drop in the studio and everybody's like, oh, hey, man, how's it going? How's the movie coming? Like, people, like, you have that recognition. You know? I've even run into some musicians and, dude, where's the movie at? How's that going? So it's like, I'm starting to kind of be like part of that scene that I've always been kind of a fan of, but on the outside of. So I think that's kind of just the coolest thing for me, is like being more a part of that space in, you know, whatever limited capacity it is.
That's really cool. Have there been any surprises that you found out while doing the interviews for the documentary or doing the research into the documentary?
Oh, that's a great question. And I feel like there are. I mean, I don't know if I call it a surprise, but my favorite thing about doing documentaries is when you find old stuff you didn't know existed. So like when I was getting stuff scheduled with Chris and Bob, And Bob texted me a few days before I got out there and he said, hey, I told our singer from Pollen that I was doing this, and I got a bunch of footage from when we were in the studio in 96. So like, we have all of this footage in Pollen in 1996 at the Blasting Room. And it's the oldest footage we have for the movie because they opened in 94, 95.
So yeah.
It's like, I never would have thought, because like, Kevin's been doing video for them for years, but his stuff starts in probably like 2004, 2005. So it goes back, but not back as far as the studio's been around. We've had a couple of bands reach out and send me like DV tapes of them at the studio, and like, it's all great. I love that stuff. It's so like, you know, just like grainy and like shitty looking, and it has that
freaking
of like the 90s, early 2000s, because like, that's how cameras looked then, you know?
Yeah.
So like, finding that old footage and him having it is like such a cool, and I didn't know we would have that. I could hope that we would, but the fact that it exists is like, you know, so cool.
Well, I suppose it gives it that real time capsule DIY feel as well, doesn't it? Like, it's a document from that time as well, which lends even more credit and legitimacy to your project.
Yeah, exactly. It also adds a layer of complexity, right? Because we're shooting everything on like new cameras in 4K, and then we're dealing with, you know, like 4:3, like very low res footage, and trying to integrate.
I was going to ask how it looks in context, because obviously, the 96 stuff, is it even digital, or had it been converted from tape to digital in the meantime?
It was definitely tape. I think they must have digitized it, because he was going to give me copies while I was there. He hadn't finished going through everything, and he was like, I don't think it can be anything. It's like 96, like, we might have said some stuff that it's like not cool. Like, I would cut that out, but I can understand why you want to review it first. So.
It was a different time. Oh, that must be awesome, though. It must be being like a fly on the wall. I love that kind of stuff. I mean, it's like the obvious example from recent times has been the Beatles' Get Back. When I first started watching that, I don't know whether you've seen it. Have you?
Not yet, no.
When I first started watching it, I was like, oh, this is slow. It's like just a couple of guys sitting in a room talking and occasionally fiddling with a guitar or whatever. But the more it goes on, the more you're like, you see the genesis of these exceptional songs, and like the amount of stuff they were just throwing out. Like, you can see the genesis of all of their solo stuff as well. It's really, really interesting. And I just think all that kind of fly on the wall stuff is just so fascinating to see how different bands work together and how the kind of egos clash and all that kind of thing. I love that.
Definitely. Well, and it's interesting too to like see their process as like the engineers in the studio and how they've evolved over the years too, right? Because like, when they started out, I'm sure they were still kind of figuring things out as far as recording music. Because you can even tell when you listen to the early things recorded at the Blasting Room versus the later stuff, it's gotten better, right? And that's a combination of the gear and then also then just getting better with it.
The three main guys, are they still hands-on involved in the day-to-day running of the Blasting Room today, or have they kind of taken a more, you know, step back approach to it now?
So the shift, so it was Bill, Stefan, and Carl were kind of like the co-owners. Carl stepped back, I forget when, but kind of early on, so it was Bill and Stefan, and then Stefan also kind of cut out. He's got his own studio in Tulsa. It's like a home studio. I don't know if he does actual recording stuff there, if he just kind of, it's just kind of his space. But so Bill's still the owner, and then Jason Livermore is the co-owner. He's also kind of the mastering person at the studio. And so they co-own the space. Bill's kind of, from what I've seen, pretty hands-off anymore. Like, he comes in for like the big stuff, like Rise Against is recording that or something. But otherwise, he's kind of backed off a little bit just because they have, you know, other engineers that are using the space and bringing in local bands, or you know, like Andrew always works with Bottle Rocket. So like Bill's worked on Bottle Rocket Records too, but usually Andrew's the one doing most of the recording stuff.
Yeah.
Jason's pretty much just mastering anymore. It's like all he does. And because he's amazing at it, which is why that's what he does. But yeah, it seems like Bill's kind of taking a step back, doing more with the Descendants, playing other live stuff, which I know he wanted to do anyway. So it's definitely good. And actually his son Miles is interested in music and recording, so he just started interning at the studio.
Oh, wow.
Which I thought was great that they're making him intern. It's not just like, oh, you're Bill's kid, you just get to work here. Like, they're running.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that must stem from the DIY working class attitude. You don't just get given something, you got to work at it.
Right. You got to clean the toilets like everybody else. And
that's excellent. So it's been a longer, more drawn out process than I'd imagine you originally envisaged back in the last part of 2019.
Oh, yeah.
In that time, have you started to think about the next project that you're going to be involved with? Or has it just been about like getting this over the line because of the difficulties that have been posed since 2020?
I have to force myself to focus on getting this done because I do have a brain that cannot stay in one place for too long. And I think too, and I don't know if this is all documentarians, but I always have like a half dozen or more ideas in the back of my mind for the next thing, you know? And what's funny is they rarely actually become the next project. Usually it's something that I hadn't even considered doing is the next thing. And one of those half dozen things will just fall to the wayside and I'll never think about it again. And it'll be replaced by some other harebrained idea that I'll probably do. Because so many of the ideas I have are like these big things that we need like a lot of money. They're maybe not big in that they don't need like, you know, 30 person crew or anything. But it's like, it's not realistic for the resources.
I think it's just part and parcel of the creative brain, isn't it? Like anyone who's got, you know, whether they're musical, whether they're filmmaking, whether it's writing, there's always something going on inside. That's and whether or not it ever makes it to fruition, you know, is anything presenting itself at the moment as the next project?
I do. It's kind of, it's hinging on if we actually make any money with the blasting room, right? Because really for me, like this is more of a hobby. Like it's kind of nice, right? Because I can like allow myself to call myself an artist because I'm not doing this to make money or to make a living. I do it because I enjoy it. So, but you know, money's all the thing. So if we make some revenue from blasting room, it's just going to get applied to the next project. That's how I'll use it most likely. And I do have an idea. It's actually going to be something not shot in the US. So I have to work with some, build a network of filmmakers elsewhere. I don't want to say too much about it yet because I never like giving away an idea until we're into it because I'm always afraid somebody's going to be like, that's a great idea and I have lots of money. Let me go shoot that. But I will say it's in a different country, but it's something that I found fascinating. I learned about it a few years ago. And this would make a really good movie. but it will be a short film. I don't want to do another feature. I need something that I can turn around a little quicker. It's so funny. So Floating Horses took like 4 years and I went into this saying I am not going to spend 4 years on my movie. We're going to do this faster. And then 4 years later, at least I can blame COVID for this one. But
yeah it's not entirely down to it's outside influences that have caused this.
Exactly. But part of why I like editing is I love to see the finished product of something. Like I like to be able to have this idea and see it all come together in the end and see what it is. So when you're spending this long on one thing, getting to that point, that's where I'm just like, it's so frustrating. I just wonder how it turns out, you know?
I suppose right now it's kind of tantalizingly close as well, isn't it?
Oh yeah, no, it's nice that we're kind of on the back end that I've been able to sit down, especially during the holidays this year, because we kind of like had a lull with, you know, again with Christmas and everything, like people are busy, you don't know about people in holidays now. So I had some time to really sit down and focus on the edit for a couple of months. And that was a really, like, again, gets me excited because you're seeing all this great stuff you have and you're digging through the footage and you're seeing these great moments where, like, you know, Phil's explaining something to Dan from out in the trail. Now it's part of why it sounds like this or whatever. Like those kind of things. Oh, this is going to be so good when we get it in the context of it. But yeah, it's I'm excited to be kind of on the back end of everything and getting into that heavy post-production work and trying to get this thing done and out in the world for people to see.
Brilliant. Well, good luck with the final piece of filming that's coming up in the next couple of weeks and also with getting it ready for South by Southwest by the end of the year. Fingers crossed for you.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's a high bar, but hopefully we can get there.
I really, really appreciate your time today to talk to me about the project, the Blasting Room documentary. Aaron Pendergast, thank you so much for coming on. I wish you all the best and I will keep an eye out for the film.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's a lot of fun.
There you go. Wasn't Aaron a brilliant storyteller with bucket loads of information on punk rock and filmmaking? I'd like to thank him for his time, as well as attempting to help with the technical issues. I'd also like to thank again Zach Eastman, host of Real Nerds, the Ballyhoo Review podcast, and Surrounded by A-Holes, for setting this up in the first place and introducing us. I hope the film is received well at South by Southwest and is picked up by one of the big streaming providers or distributors. I can't wait to see it. Hopefully, once it's been released, I'll catch up with Aaron again and you can hear him slightly more clearly next time. In the meantime, check out the project at blastingroomfilm.com or on Instagram at blastingroomfilm and let him know I sent you. As ever, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and until next time, take care. Thank you for listening to this episode of Band Biographies. If you enjoyed it, please don't forget to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whatever service you use to listen to your podcasts. Please do reach out on Twitter at BandBiogs, Instagram at BandBiographies, search on Facebook for BandBiographies, or by emailing bandbiographies@gmail.com. See you next time.